The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and to my left is the Honorable Sarita the Edge Edgerton.
Represent.
You are representing. Representing
Tative.
The 34th district of South Carolina. And behind the glass is Rocket Man Andy Bishop.
Pacow.
To my right, Rick Big Daddy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
And he's always extra bassy today.
Very bassy. He's Count Basie. Nobody gets that joke, do they?
Yes.
That's an old reference. And we have a special little treat here. We've got our friend Cherry Lewis. Hello, Cherry.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
Cherry. I'm so excited.
She's up in Maine, and she said she would join us when she could, and so she's joining us as she could.
Hi, Cherry.
Yeah, and we've also got... Tiziana, Mom So Hard Severse.
What's up, folks?
How you momming so hard today?
I'm hiding in the basement. I'm literally hiding in the basement. I told my kids I had to go record the podcast, then got in my car, drove to the neighbor's house, parked my car in her garage, and then snuck in through the basement so that they don't know that I'm
here. So they don't know
that
you're home.
What an elaborate hoax.
That's wonderful.
What an elaborate hoax.
Yes, absolutely.
I know. I mean, really, let's see. Let me just pat myself. That's how good of a mom I am. That if they think I'm anywhere in a 50-mile radius, they, want me to be present.
How do you mom so hard? You lie to your children.
I know. Why am I lying so hard? Yeah. My mom's so hard today by hiding in the basement with a glass of wine.
Okay? Yes.
That's pretty momming.
That's very mommy.
Yeah. Yep.
So... I'm super excited about this episode. Woo! So excited.
So excited.
I couldn't even imagine. I never thought that this would happen.
No. So, I got a call early in the morning.
I know.
I was so excited, like a kid at Christmas.
Well, this gentleman who is joining us today, I reached out via email this past weekend, and I just took a shot. You know me.
I just take a shot.
Like, you never know.
Right.
Because I've been watching his videos. I'm reading his books. I'm fascinated by what this man is teaching.
Yep.
And I'm like, I want to talk to this guy. And so I just put it out there, and he responded. Ooh. And I was like, what?
What?
So, ladies and gentlemen,
how often that works. It's
I know.
Cool.
And
amazing.
He's so kind. I was like, what? So he's Dr. John H. Walton. Welcome to the Burrows of Berea, sir.
Great to be here.
Yeah, it's so much fun. When I watch your videos, first of all, I love your humor. You've always got a little bit of joke all the time going on.
That's good.
And yeah, he does. And he's got a lot of our humor. Not necessarily Billy Kinsey's humor.
No,
but he has our humor, kind of the dad joke humor.
Well, can I tell a joke then?
You can. You want to tell a joke?
Sure.
Sarita's got a joke.
All right. So I had a constituent come up to me today and say, 2 years ago, my brother ran for Congress. And so I asked him, what does he do now? And he said, nothing. He got elected.
Yes.
And that is a true statement.
That is, yeah, I'm sure.
From the inside.
Well, guys, Dr. John Walton is an emeritus professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College in Illinois and an editor and writer of Old Testament Comparative Studies and Commentaries. Throughout his research, Walton has focused his attention on comparing the culture and literature of the Bible and the ancient Near East. He has published over 30 books, articles, dozens and dozens of articles and translations, both as writer and editor, including his book, which is the one that I've brought with me today, The Lost World of Genesis 1.
That's fascinating.
Get ready, Andy, because you're going to love this. After we talked with Dr. Craig Olson about archaeology last year, this is going to be a treat for you because Dr. Walton has a very, some people would call it controversial. I wouldn't call it controversial. Some people say it's controversial.
We won't do that.
But rather than me take up time, Dr. Walton, I want to start off with just a quick question about you personally. So you are a Christian believer. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yes, I thought so. And you've always said so in your videos, so I assume that was the same. Now, tell us a little bit. I want to focus in on a little bit on this Lost World series. And one of the things that I loved about your videos, you talk about this thing called the cultural river. And could you help our audience understand what you mean by cultural river? And I think it's really important to set the stage for our audience to understand you're approaching Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 very different than we are used to in our traditional view.
So I try to read the Old Testament as an ancient piece of literature. Not just an ancient piece of literature, it's scripture. It was their scripture, it's our scripture, but it's ancient. And so one of the things I like to say is that it was written for us, but not to us. Mm-hmm. It was written to another culture in another time in another language, and we have to take account of that. The way that I describe that is that the Bible is insider to insider communication. That is, it's Israelites writing to Israelites, and they share the same culture, they share the same national experiences, they share the same history, they share a lot of assumptions that don't have to be explained when they're speaking to one another, when they're writing to one another. We know how it is with insider-to-insider communication. When you're talking to someone in your in-group, you can assume a lot of background knowledge and you don't have to repeat it or explain it. But when you're talking to an outsider, now that would require more explanation. So the Bible is insider to insider communication. They are not anticipating any other cultural river, that is, any other culture except their own. They're certainly not anticipating mine, and they wouldn't understand mine if I tried to explain it to them. So they're in their cultural river. I come to that communication as an outsider. And therefore, some things that were common knowledge among the author and his audience are not common knowledge to me. Some things that could be assumed by the author about his audience, he could not assume about me. And so therefore, if I'm going to read the Bible well, I have to try to penetrate as much as I can that insider communication by understanding the language, by understanding the culture, by trying to get on their wavelength so that we're on the same page. That's very difficult to do. The way I want to start doing that is by recognizing those things that are part of our cultural set of assumptions and trying to move them out of the way a bit. We can't get rid of them. We're stuck in them. Our cultural river is what it is. We can't change it. We're in it, whether we like it or not. There's parts we like, there's parts we don't like. It involves economics and politics and science and values and society. All of those aspects are cultural river. There's parts we like, there's parts we don't like. But whether we're resisting or floating comfortably on the currents, that's our context. And that's where our conversations take place, how we understand things and how we talk about things. We are in a room of conversation. The Israelites were also in a room of conversation, and it's not the same room at all. And therefore, if I want to read the Old Testament well, I have to try to get out of my room of conversation and into their room of conversation.
Sure. That one thing I can tell you about our audience, so we've introduced them to the concept of audience relevance in the scriptures. And it's something that was new for me. I grew up a Baptist. I read the Bible very literally. I thought of a lot of things that were physical, that were most likely symbolic, and things that were symbolic. You know, I guess just being raised in this Baptist upbringing, I saw everything. And I was also looking at the Bible kind of like a newspaper. And I remember in one of your videos, you're like, it's not a newspaper. We're reading other people's mail. And we have to remember that we're doing that. And so we're pretty used to that. But what was a shock about your work was, like, let's take Genesis 1, for example. I think the biggest shock to my system was that what you're interpreting is that we're really not talking about material creation as much as we are form and function. And I liked how you described, and I'd like for you to describe it again, maybe for our audience, about the difference between a house and a home.
Sure. So when I started to see this direction for interpretation, it was because I asked a critical question that I had not been asking previously. And that question was, what kind of creation account is this? because in the frame of mind that I was raised in and that I was thinking in at that time, that really wasn't a question. What, how could there be different kinds of creation accounts? But when it finally occurred to me that, yes, indeed, there could be, then that opened a whole new area of investigation for me. You know, we might ask somebody about a play. We might ask, how did the play begin? And one person might describe the script being written. Another person might describe the set being built. Another person might describe the cast being chosen. And those are all important beginning points. But maybe you really only wanted to know what happened since the curtain opened. Right. So that's an example that there are different kinds of answers to how did the world begin. Just as there might be different kinds of answers to how did the play begin. They're not contradictory. They're just different perspectives. And so I started asking, what perspective did they have in the ancient world? When I first wrote Lost World of Genesis 1, the only contrast to material that I could think of was function. And so that's the term I used in the contrast. I talked about a functional ontology, that things exist when they have a function. And I talked about that as a contrast to a material ontology, that things exist when they have materiality. In the time since then, and you'll find this in my new book that, by the way, just came out last week, New Explorations.
I read the wrong book.
New Explorations.
Oh, no.
Is that the one you got, the brand new one?
She didn't get the new one, no.
I got the first one. Yeah. So one of the things I was really interested in was this idea of, is a material reality created once it's brought into being? If that's the case, one of the things you said in your book, Dr. Walton, you're like, okay, so a chair is created when I have chopped all of the wood and I've glued the thing together and now it's a chair. It's a material reality. But what about a corporation? What about a business? When is its creation, quote unquote? And so if you're going to change, because I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. If you're about to change that analogy, I'm in trouble because
I'm not changing it. This is not a revised edition. It's an update on the conversations called New Explorations in the Lost World of Genesis. And in that, I reflect a change that I started to make probably 6-7 years ago because I found that the concept of function was a stumbling block for people. They didn't really understand what I was getting at. They misunderstood kind of the essence idea. And I found a better word. It incorporates the idea of function, but I think it's much better and it's much more reflected in the ancient world. And that is the concept of order, bringing order rather than manufacturing material. Now, I used the term order in the initial book because I talked about function having to do with a role and a purpose in an ordered system. And there it was. But now I emphasize order a lot more because that seems to be really the key element. That's one of the highest values, if not the highest value in the ancient world. So it's still the same idea, but a little bit different terminology. So house and home, house is the material. It's what your house is made of. It's the foundation, the framing, the roof, the air conditioning, the plumbing, the electricity. That's the house. And you can tell your house story, and that's a great story. And it's an origin story. And a house is where you live. And if that's what you're trying to describe, that's an important story. But you can also tell another creation story, and that's the home story. The home story is how you use your home, how it functions, how it's ordered, what room is for what, whose room is whose. Where do you put the furniture? How do you organize the cabinets? That's an issue of order. And so it's not a contradictory story. It's just a different perspective. So you could talk about a house story of creation, and that would be our material world. You could talk about a home story, how it's ordered and how it works. There's our word function, what its purpose is. That's a home story. A house is where you live. A home is where your story comes to life. Okay, I got that from a real estate commercial, but it's really good.
It doesn't matter where it comes from. That's a great way of explaining that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So my contention in these books is that Israel is not really interested in the house story. We are, and that's how we talk about how did the world begin. We want to tell a house story. But I try to present that Israel's most interested in the home story. And that God is the one who set up the home. Yes, he built the house, but who cares? That's not something that they're very interested in. And so for Israel, creation, the most essential story of creation is a home story. And once we understand that, it changes how we read Genesis. One.
Absolutely. And the other side of this too, and that's why I was excited about this guest, Andy, was because, you know, for us, even in this studio, we've talked about, like, we went all the way back to the beginning, you know, how things were created and it was material.
Yeah.
And that's the way that I'd always seen it. But yeah,
I never even thought about it.
I hadn't
that
either.
Other way. No, that's completely new thought to me.
Yeah, and I remember when he was telling the story about the house and home, he was talking about coming to that play, and he's like, imagine coming to the play late and sitting down next to somebody and say, okay, so, you know, what did I miss? And he was like, well, you know, this playhouse was built in 1912. Yeah. And it's like, no, we don't have to go that far back, right? You know? Yeah. I thought totally. It was very
that's
funny.
That's what I mean. Yeah, that's good. It's a really...
They did Hamlet here.
Yeah.
It's an interesting... That's a new framing for me, and I'm fascinated. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. And
you
I know...
It's interesting because there are some times where we think that way today as well. When you start a new job, first day on the job, you don't ask for the architectural plans for the building that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
You ask for the organizational chart of who reports to who and who's in charge of, you know, your evaluation, who you report to. You know, it's order, not material. You don't care who built the building and what the architectural plans look like. So there are just ways that we think of that today. I use the example of a computer. If I ask you about your laptop, you probably won't tell me about the polymers in the screen or the chips on the motherboard. You'll talk to me about the apps and the operating system. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an order story, not a material story. And we know that there are chips on the motherboard and polymers in the screen, but we don't care.
Actually, I just learned that thing about polymers in the screen.
Here's the thing that's really interesting. We have a Western modern scientific thinking culture. We like to get down to the brass tacks about everything, the origins of things and how things, you know, are made and work. And, you know, we argue those points. And I think that's the way that our mind works. I never even considered how they interpreted their world, really.
Yeah, that's such a fundamental cultural difference that I don't know how you could have seen it coming without having... Or I could have seen it coming without having actually studied more cultures to understand that that might be a framing problem.
Right. So,
well, and it challenges.
Go ahead.
It challenges also the concept of beginning. And that's what we're all talking about here. When a house becomes a house versus when a house becomes a home. And when you are going to tell a story, when you start a story once upon a time, you're not suggesting that there was absolutely nothing prior to that once upon a time. It's just that your once upon a time starts here in the timeline because that's the story that you're about to tell. And so like with Genesis 1 and what Dr. Walton, you know, what I got from it, and correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is that in the beginning when God began to create, you know, and you go into the Hebrew for the word bara and what that means, you're not suggesting that there was absolutely nothing in the whole universe. You're suggesting that that was the beginning of God creating order and function in the universe using the materials that already existed. They were already there. You were talking about how the earth was formless and void. What the actual Hebrew in that word was without function and order. It's not that it wasn't there. It was absolutely totally there, just chilling, just waiting for somebody to make it do good things.
So if we go back to the home story idea, when you move into a new place, you know, first day the movers have just left, and what have you got? You've got all the furniture jumbled together in one place. You've got all the boxes in the corner. And that's Genesis 1:2. That's tohu vavohu. That's formless and void, or without order. Again, we say formless, which to us speaks of material. That is a material shape. That's not what that says. That says it's without order. And so the beginning point is not lacking matter. It talks about the earth. It's lacking order. And that's like the jumble of boxes in the corner. And then you have to work at bringing order to the home by unpacking, putting things in drawers and cabinets, arranging things the way you want them so that it's ordered to work the way you want it to work, function and purpose.
That's what's really interesting to me too is... And we talk about this in our podcast all the time, Dr. Walton, because it's really frustrating. It's frustrating for me. It's that I wish that I had a Bible that said, and the earth was without order versus without, you know, without form and void. And I'm curious, you know, I don't want to go, you know, too far down the line here, but in your opinion, I mean, do you feel like the translators are interpreting it incorrectly? Are they looking? Do you think the original translators were doing this based off of a material creation versus the way you're describing it?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, that's the way everybody has thought throughout the history of the church. They've assumed that it's material because they're already in a cultural river that's too removed from the ancient world. Because remember, the ancient world, the Assyro-Babylonian world, was conquered by the Persians. Total sea change in Persian culture. And that lasted for 2 centuries. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about America, 2 centuries, okay? And that totally changed their culture. And then, of course, here comes Alexander the Great. And again, total sea change. So by the time you even get to New Testament, they're too removed from the ancient world. They don't know the ancient cultural river. They only know their Greco-Roman world. They certainly don't know the Achaemenid world of the Persians. They only know their Greco-Roman world, and they talk in that cultural river. Again, insider to insider. Greco-Roman culture people, Jews in Greco-Roman culture, talking to Jews and, of course, eventually Gentiles in Greco-Roman culture. And we have to take that seriously.
And it seems that, I'm sorry, Sarita, I'll let you take over. It seems that Jesus, when he's speaking, he takes it back to the beginning. Like, he's going back to the way it was meant, correct?
Sometimes, yes. Like when he talks about Torah and corrects the Pharisees on their understanding of the law. Certainly then he is. But in most cases, Jesus also is an insider talking to insiders. Mm-hmm. He assumes a Greco-Roman world and Greco-Roman ways to think about things.
In order to speak, much like God did at different times within culture, he's speaking to people within their culture at their time with the words that they understand.
Effective communication always involves accommodation.
Wow. Sorry. Go ahead, Sarita.
By definition.
Well, I think that if you go to either John 1 or 1 John 1, both of them are very similar. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. Well, the word logos is bringing order to chaos. And that's an interpretation of that. So even those two passages are confirming, you know, what he's saying, bring order to the chaos. Now we think, again, that void, bringing order to that void. But what he's saying is more like, I take you and you buy a house. Theoretically, that house is empty. When you buy it, somebody's moved out, or it's a new build. And the beginning of your journey begins when you sign those papers, but the beginning of the house's journey was 6, 8, 9 months ago, or 30 years ago when it was built, whenever it started the building. But then you and Holly go in and you add your furniture and your decorations and the things that make you order it according to
make it the Welch home.
Yes, to make it the Welch home, not the Edgerton home or the Carter home. But so I would think that that's a very similar illustration as well.
Yeah. So I'm curious, Dr. Walton, if you have, and I'll just ask you straight up, how much of the Bible do you think is actually talking about material creation, if at all?
So the way I pose that question to myself is, if the Bible wanted to talk about the material aspect of creation, what kinds of things would it say? Okay. And I think that there are, again, I've got this in the new book, there are lines that express that. When it says that the Lord laid the foundations of the earth, that's a material statement. It's not a material story. It's a material statement.
Okay.
The Lord stretched out the heavens. That's a material statement, but it's not a material story. When they want to tell the story, they want to tell the order story.
Yeah, I'm beginning to see that more and more.
You know, in relation to what was just said earlier about John 1, you know, notice also in Hebrews 1, okay? But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he also made the universe. I'm reading NIV. The universe. That word is cosmos. And we think of cosmos as the physical universe. But in Greek, that's not what it is. Cosmos is the ordered world.
Yeah. Now, are you sure? That world is actually aeon, isn't it? It's not cosmos there.
You're You may be right.
Uh-oh.
But again, it didn't use Cosmos.
Sure, yeah. And I see that Aeon, and it's actually Aeonus, which I believe is a plural, ages.
Right, you're right. But it does not use Cosmos. It uses ages, right, which talks about the flow of history. I think that's also the case in Hebrews 11:1, if I recall.
I agree, yep.
Which, to follow along, the ages would have been there have been a particular order to the ages,
mm-hmm.
because the definition for ages is a cycle of time. So in order for the cycle of time to be a cycle of time, right. It has to be in order.
Cycles and patterns, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I have a question, and I'm going to go back a little bit to your cultural river theme. Considering that you speak about a cultural river, and that any river flowing through any land or country or whatever has some type of control upon the area that it's flowing through, say the Grand Canyon in itself, it has etched its way into the stone with the control that it has. How much of the culture at the time that the writers are writing has an actual effect on the writings? The beginning of Genesis, the Israelites are living in Egypt because it's said that Genesis is written by Moses, or at least the first five books. They're Egyptian, to some degree, cultured Israelites. How much do you think that has effect during that period of time on the writings at the time?
Whatever cultural river they are in has to have an effect. There's no way it can't have an effect. Again, you have conversations, you write to an audience that is in your cultural river. Now, question there is, how much does it reflect an Egyptian cultural river, or were those texts written later and reflect more a Babylonian cultural river? That's the conversation. But it's one or the other, and it could possibly be a mixture of both. That is, you may have vestiges of an Egyptian cultural river and yet have some reflections of a Mesopotamian one. Again, that's difficult to sort out, although we can see both kinds of elements in various parts of the Old Testament.
From your study in the Hebrew through the Old Testament, can you say that you can see at certain points through the Old Testament where you see a change in a cultural writing in Hebrew because of their living through different cultures?
Not so much, because as I talked about in Lost World of Scripture, it's likely that the books we have took their final shape more toward the exile or even the post-exilic period, even if they were already circulating orally and maybe in some documents at much earlier times. By the time they get incorporated into literary works, they're in the Iron Age.
So basically, the culture had already been written out of it.
Or the culture of the time that it was finalized was written into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Perhaps to some extent. Again, that doesn't mean the vestiges weren't preserved from an earlier cultural river.
Yeah, I mean, we do it all the time. I mean, we preserve culture. We have a modern American culture, but we preserve a lot of ancient culture.
Try to read Dickens.
Yeah, Count Basie.
I can read it, but it's only because I'm used to the KJV.
Dickens isn't hard, but it's you know what I mean? That's a pretty big change in the English language. And not necessarily so much in the ideas, a little bit, but it's a pretty big change, even though it's the same language.
Right.
But the implications, the thing is that the implications of this particular read of Genesis and what this frees us from is this kind of consistent eternal argument about whether or not this is an account of material creation or not, if we are capable of recognizing, as Dr. Walton is suggesting, that what the account is an ordering of the universe by God, right? Then that really frees us to take a look at what are some of the theological implications of the way that was ordered, especially when you juxtapose it against other ancient Near East writings like the Enuma Elish? Because one of the things that I kept coming back to as I thought about this, as I was listening to your book, Dr. Walton, on 0.17 times speed while trying to ignore the sound of Cocomelon in the background. But you know, like I kept having these like incredible aha moments because, for example, in the Enuma Elish, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I remember correctly, human beings are created in the Enuma Elish at the end after Tiamat's been split and, you know, Marduk's in charge. They're created and they're enslaved in order to, you know, provide food for the gods and to take care of the land, okay? Again, if we're like removing ourselves from the idea of material creation and we're instead asking, is this how these individuals, how this culture imagined their selves being placed in the order of their God's universe, then you have the account in creation in Genesis where Adam is created for relationship with God.
And again, a very different focus.
But it frees you up to think about those kinds of things if you're not spending all of your time and energy like thinking about whether or not this is a literal material creation. You're now free to like think about, well, what are some of the larger implications when you talk about day seven and that being the day of rest and it being the time that God actually then settled in and inhabited the creation
and rules
that he had made.
He rules the kingdom.
In order to rule and reign and organize that kingdom. What are the, you mean, stop and think about the implications of that, considering that in ancient times, gods were deeply attached to their particular lands. That's actually kind of like a bold statement for the Hebrew people to make, that their God actually then enthroned himself over the whole world. And then later on, when you see God ride in a chariot to follow his people to Babylon, it helps to maybe open our minds to think about God and how unique that conceptualization of God in the ancient Near East world and in those traditional cosmologies would be, and like how cool it is now that we get to participate in being a part of that story as it has continued.
And that again is an element of how the Israelites in an insider-to-insider conversation are in conversation with their world, with the questions and issues of their world, not the questions and issues of our world. If this is not a material account, then this has nothing whatsoever to do with the question of the age of the earth. But it does have to do with who's in charge and who rules. So we talk about this this interaction with a silent conversation partner. The Babylonians are there, the Egyptians are there, and the Israelites are interacting with their ideas, but they don't. There's no dialogue. It's just the Israelites talking. Some have thought that, or have expressed that, the Israelite account in Genesis is polemic. And I think that's too strong a word, because a polemic, you're actually trying to argue against a position that you've stated and that's right on the table. This is a little more subtle. And so I think the better word is subversion. That is by giving their view of the cosmos with their God ruling, bringing order, they are subverting subtly, tacitly, subverting kind of other viewpoints, including the one you've mentioned, that the gods created people in order to meet their needs. That's not at all the Genesis 1 account. They've got a totally different story to tell. And they don't spend time trying to debunk the other one. They just give theirs.
I always thought that Genesis 2 was kind of like a polemic because of, you know, the serpent being in that place and thinking of Egypt and where the Israelites came from, you know, like the serpent gods. I had thought that, but by mentioning that it's more subversive, I can totally see that, and especially in Genesis 1. But have you ever, I'm sure you've considered this, you've been doing this for years and years, but have you heard that Genesis 2, some people have seen that as a polemic?
Certainly, there's all kinds of things through these early chapters of Genesis that people see as polemic. But I always ask the question, has the other view been stated? Is there arguing against an identified view? When I look at the serpent in Genesis 3, I see a chaos creature.
Yeah, I said Genesis 2. Sorry about that.
So again, Christian theology sees Satan, but Genesis Israelites would not see Satan. They would see a chaos creature because that's their world. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, and here's the subversion there. In Enuma Elish, that's the most easily referenced example, the gods bring order by defeating chaos. They defeat Tiamat. Marduk defeats Tiamat and her 11 monsters. And so chaos is defeated, and then order of creation is brought. What's interesting, of course, when you read Genesis 1, immediately you notice that there's no conflict in chapter 1. God doesn't have to defeat chaos. Non-order is there, but God doesn't have to do battle with it. He just brings order into the midst of non-order with no conflict immediate. But here's the interesting part. You get to chapter 3, and after people have decided that they want to be their own order bringers, they want to bring order for themselves, for their benefit, by themselves. That's what the fruit is. It's the fruit of order, knowing good and evil, knowing order and non-order. God created them as image bearers to be order bringers, but that's supposed to be his order. People decided they wanted to bring their own order. And then in 3:15, God says, you ask for it, you've got it. Now the fight is yours. You have to fight the chaos creature. And there'll be a battle, enmity. And he'll have strikes against your heel, potentially mortal, poisonous snakes. And you'll have strikes against his head, potentially mortal, crushed heads. But the battle is ongoing, and it doesn't tell you who wins. The verbs are the same, and they're both potentially mortal blows. And 3:15 is picking up this idea of bringing order in the face of chaos, but instead of God doing that battle, he gives it to them. And it makes 3:15 a very important verse and one that we've badly misunderstood.
I was going to say, because we've heard that as the proto-evangelium, and that's, they consider, you know, the first gospel. And so that many people believe that this was the first prophecy of Christ. So you believe that that's an incorrect interpretation.
Sure, because it doesn't even say who wins.
Yeah, I always wondered about that, because it doesn't say that he kills him. It just says that they strikes and crush. It doesn't say kill. Yeah. Interesting.
So there's this ongoing battle, so it doesn't say who wins. Some people have tried to see the singular seed as a subtle reference to Christ. But seed has to be singular there, because the Hebrew word for seed is collective, and therefore singular, requires singular pronouns. So the singular doesn't have any meaning other than grammatical. So 3:15 says, from generation to generation to generation, you have decided you're going to fight order, or bring order, fight chaos on your own. The battle's yours. You ask for it, you've got it. And but he does tamp down the serpent a bit. That is the crawling on the ground, eating dust. I mean, that puts a handicap. So he handicaps the serpent. But then he says the battle's yours.
It's a fascinating read of Genesis. Absolutely,
it's
fascinating.
So interesting.
But look,
I mean, yeah.
Sorry, Tiziana, but I wanted, Andy, I wanted you to hear this direct, straight from the Walton's mouth. Are you ready? All right. So in his book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, okay? Adam and Eve is such a wild, it's like a wild thought to me, all right? But I've always interpreted it as that, for example, very literally, God formed him from the dust of the ground. I've always thought of it as a, like, misshapen clay that he forms into clay, and he breathes into him the breath of life. I've always seen it as a very physical, material kind of thing. And then later that he puts him into a deep sleep, and then he opens up the side, and he takes out the rib, and then he makes Eve, right? So I've always looked at that very materially. But that is not what's actually going on in the language. Okay.
Okay.
Do you mind, Dr. Walton, kind of giving us an overview of the way that you have interpreted that?
So in 2:7, the Lord God formed humanity, dust from the ground, right? People have made, Christians have made a really, really, really big deal by saying this verse proves that evolution is anti-biblical, because the verse specifically says that God formed Adam from the dust. And that means that there are no predecessors, there are no processes, this is de novo creation, and there it is, evolutionary models won't work. Here's the hitch. There's no preposition there. The Lord God formed humanity. No preposition. As a matter of fact, there's a disjunctive break there. And that means, I choose, would say, you need to view it epexegetically. That is, I know that word's strange. The Lord God formed humanity, colon, semicolon, something. And then explanation, dust from the ground. Not from the dust. There is no preposition. So it says what people are, not what they're from. They are dust, which...
Just like we often say, you're all just made of star stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not even talking about that even.
Which means they're created mortal. Dust is mortality. So they're created mortal.
Yes.
Which also puts to rest this idea that without that, prior to the quote unquote fall, there was no death in the world. There had to have been death in the world prior to the fall. Right. You know? Because the fall wasn't necessarily about now you're going to die. It's now you've chosen to battle chaos. And in that moment, you are also choosing to have this, you know, this challenging life where you could have had you could have had an easy life just following my order.
You wanted to do it on your own. You've got it. And by the way, my new book picks this up even stronger. In Lost World of Adam and Eve, I talked about them as archetypes. In the new book, that comes across much more stronger. The idea of archetypes is they are us. We are them. What they are, we are. What they do, we do. That's the archetype idea. So we're not supposed to talk about them and us. Oh, they're this and we're this. You know, he was made from dust, but now I was born of a woman. You know, no, this is not an us them. And it's not even supposed to be a before. It is descriptive of human identity. The word formed there, the Lord God formed humanity. That word more often has to do with identity than with material. Check out Psalm 103. So we are dust. He knows our form. Zechariah 12, he formed our spirit, our ruach. Forming is an identity issue, not a shape.
Material creation. Yeah.
Right.
Which also, to me, one of the things that really also, because, you know, speaking in that same, you know, traveling down that same path, because you talk about Adam and Eve and the word good, and good means to have function. It's not when it says God created and it was good, it doesn't mean that God's craftsmanship was awesome. Like we wouldn't need to specify that God's craftsmanship was awesome because it probably was. There would be no need to say, and God wasn't crappy at building stars. He was good at it.
And the way
you're saying is that.
Some would say he was the best ever.
It has
ever.
To do with giving it a function.
Thought I'd never hear that in a sentence.
And our new word works better here. That is, good is in the order spectrum, not order. The moral spectrum.
Yeah, so and order.
It's good means it's ordered.
Right, and so when man was alone and that was not good, it meant that man was unable to function in its full capacity without the female. And so the partner, so the partner was made in order to have the proper form and function of what God had how God intended himself to be represented on earth. It needed to both parties to be able to function properly. And I feel like that's got some pretty serious implications in terms of what Christianity especially has later sort of defined woman as, which is of course this like subordinate creature created after, you know, underneath and all of this stuff. Can you either correct my liberal feminist ideology that I got excited about or
So my son recently finished his doctoral dissertation at St. Andrews, and he wrote on the order spectrum in Genesis 2 through 4. And one of the things that he brings, he's changed my mind on lots of different things in small ways and a couple big ways. And his work is represented in my new book as well. One of the things that he noticed is that when it says it's not good for man to be alone, there's no implication that it's perfectly fine for women to be alone. When it says it's not good for humanity to be alone, and the result of that, certainly it goes talking about woman, but the result is community. The answer is not woman. The answer is community. And so really this transcends gender roles to talking about how when there's lack of community, there is lack of order. Order requires community. And so
mind blowing. It's very corporate, isn't it?
We've made it a gender thing.
we've made it a gender construct. And in so doing, it's become reductive. Like we've removed the actual majesty of the design by focusing on these material definitions of things. And what do I read next? Because now that you've got 30 books, now they're being revised.
You need to read his latest that his son helped write. You need to read this latest one. Hello, all you Burroughs listeners. If you guys want to help us financially keep this podcast going, just go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/theburroughsofberea. Let me say that again. www.patreon, that's patreon.com/theburroughsofberea. We have several different levels that you can give at. So again, if you'd like to help us keep this podcast on the air, then just give us all your money at www.patreon.com/theburroughsofberea. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, this is not a revision. This is the next step up. So so in this new book, I'm updating terminology. I'm updating analogies and illustrations. I'm updating new information, new conversations, and occasionally I'm changing my mind, and I'm representing my son's work in that. He wrote 5 sections in the book to give his work. So this is not a revised edition. It is kind of updating the conversation. And that's important because I speak about this stuff hundreds of times all over the world, and I learn new ways to communicate. I learn new ways to think. And so, we're just trying to keep...
It's huge to hear you say that. Like somebody who has so much education and so much experience and has traveled, to hear you say that at this juncture in your like illustrious career, and I use that word in all of its full power, to hear you say that you are still in process, that you're still having aha moments, that you're still allowing like your understanding of God to be larger and more expansive than what you thought. Anytime somebody says, well, the Bible's very clear about such and such, I'm like, you haven't read it.
Yeah, a lot of times that's what it feels like, doesn't it? Yeah.
You know? Wow. So when does your new book come out? Is it already out?
It just came out last week.
Oh my Lord, last week. What's the name of it? I'm writing it down.
New Explorations in the Lost World of Genesis.
So what I'm going to do in the show notes is I'm going to have a link to John Walton's books.
He has a number of books on Audible. A couple of them are free with your subscription.
Yeah, very cool.
The new one doesn't look like it's up yet, though.
Oh, yeah. Was that InterVarsity Press?
Yes.
Okay.
It doesn't launch on Amazon until April 15th.
Okay. I'll be checking
Amazon
that one out.
Not ship it to you. Until April 15th, but you can get it from Ivy Press now.
Okay, so Ivy Press. Okay. What I'll do, guys, because this episode's coming out next Thursday, I will put a link in the show notes so that you can go to the InterVarsity Press and be able to buy it there. Would it be possible in the future, Dr. Walton, if we all get this book and we actually spend some time and read it, that we could actually invite you back in a few months and talk about this? Would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
That's incredible.
There's one podcast. I was on a podcast earlier today. And they've set up 8 podcasts, one a month, to talk about each of the Lost World books.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, that's incredible.
So if, and I'm just new to this, and I didn't listen to any of your stuff because I was supposed to be somewhere else tonight. But so I have been reading some Dr. Heiser books, Michael Heiser books. And so kind of what you're saying goes a lot along with what he believes about, you know, God having, you know, a family, a spiritual family, and then having a human family, if you will. And so have you read Dr. Michael Heiser's works?
I've read his work, and Michael was a friend of mine. Of course, he passed away recently.
Mm-hmm. Was it last year?
Yeah.
And, we had a lot in common. I knew him when he was a grad student, when he worked at Logos. We've done stuff together. We both agree on the importance of the ancient Near Eastern context. However, when you get to issues of the Divine Council and understanding the Divine Council, we go very different directions than what he does. Mm-hmm. The idea of God being in community, I agree with that. Of course, people don't understand that when you talk about polytheism in the ancient world, it's not about the number of gods. It's about the gods acting in community and being in community. There is a community of the gods. That's what's important about polytheism, how the world is run, how they interact with one another. And each god finds their identity in that community. That's why it was so difficult for Israel to be told there's only one God, because they themselves as people have communal identity is the way they think. And so if they think they have their identity in their community, well, now what do you do with a God who has no community? How's that even work? How could that even be? You can see why they were a little confused. But what happens is God says, I don't have a community of gods. There are no other gods before me in my presence. I'm not in a divine community. Instead, you are my community. You are my people. I want to live with you. I want to live among you. I want to be in relationship with you. I have chosen you as my community. It was a tough thing for them to grasp. But at any rate, this is a point at which Michael and I differ, because Michael still sees the divine council as the community of the divine. I'm more inclined to see the divine council as God's accommodation, just like cosmic geography. He didn't correct their cosmic geography. He used what they knew. And I'm more inclined to think that way. If you're interested in seeing that more fully developed, my son and I wrote a book together called Demons and Spirits in Biblical Theology. And we cover every passage in Old and New Testament that either talks about Satan or demons, or that people think talks about Satan or demons. We talk about Genesis 3 and the serpent. We talk about the supposed fall of Satan. We talk about all of Jesus casting out of demons, Job and the divine council, all of those passages. So that's where people could find that.
Wow, spirits and demons.
So much reading to do.
Yes.
Demons and spirits.
All right.
Demons and spirits. So much reading to do.
I got a big, just out of your statement that you said, I got a big question. Considering Israel's struggle with trying to understand that their only God had no community. Dealing with cultural reference during the period of time that when Israel becomes a nation upon itself in Egypt, they are under slavery of a group of people that had a community of gods. Their God, they didn't have one God, they had multiple gods and a community of God.
At Egypt. Yeah.
So through their cultural living in Egypt, when they leave it, would that culture have any impact on their difficulty to understand that their God is only one God with no community?
That's like that's what Absolutely. You just said. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think you see that struggle when they're actually in the desert. Mm-hmm. You know, we hear them, we always joke, and I don't know if you joke, but I joke about it. They whine a lot while they're walking around in circles. And, you know, what they're actually, and then they'll go, we should just go back to Egypt. Like, I always wondered, did they actually really want to turn around and go back and be slaves? Like, I've always struggled with that part, but maybe what they were saying, and maybe you can correct me on this, is let's go back to what we knew with all of these multi-gods. We know that this God is responsible for fertility, and this God is responsible for this, and this God is, and there's a whole pantheon of gods for them to choose from, whereas they only had this one God who was pretty strict about what he wanted them to do, and maybe that's what they wanted to go back to, that which was familiar, instead of this new God who had no other pantheon around him.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was some of that in it. That's not the way they say it. They talk about the security and the food and the provision that they had back in Egypt. So that's what they refer to. Whether those other aspects were part of it or not, can't say because the text doesn't, but it wouldn't be a surprise. All through the Judges period, remember, 4 centuries or so, they continue to worship these other gods. And that doesn't mean that they were rejecting their God. Remember Gideon's story. Gideon, when he's talking to the angel, says, you know, where have you been? You know, here we are under the thumb of these invaders, and we hear about all this stuff you did for our ancestors. Like, Where are you? What's the problem? And of course, we find out by the end of the chapter that he's got a Baal statue and an Asherah in his backyard. He still understood Yahweh as their national God, but they were filling in a community for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what ran them into problems. And that goes all the way through the monarchy period. So,
wow.
And Elijah fought the pantheon of the old gods versus his one God, and his one God showed up big time in that situation.
Right.
The way that, Sarita, the way you were defining like Israel coming out of Egypt and thinking about wanting to go back, it kind of makes me think about what it's like for me, like when I first read John Walton's work. And I was like, it rips your mind out, especially if you're traditional. I know that I'm not very traditional, you know, in here, but really, like, I'm very comfortable with my old Baptist upbringing. You know what I mean? Like, I have those moments when I kind of want, you know, when my eschatological views changed, then really I wanted to vomit. A lot of times I wanted to vomit because I couldn't go back. I couldn't go back where I once was. But interpreting Genesis this way, looking at Genesis this way, is so liberating. The only thing that I was afraid of when I read this, and he settled this for me in one of his videos, was I was concerned about what the New Testament means about being an Adam and what, you know, how Adam brought sin in. If there were other people that were made in Genesis 1 that weren't from Adam and Eve and weren't their descendants, then would they be held to the same standard as the rest of the Israelites? Were the Goyim never really charged with sin? And one of the things that Dr. Walton brings in is that, you know what? What the Bible says is that sin entered the world through them. Period. If there were already people there, it doesn't matter. Sin entered the world through them. That sacred space had been taken away from them. The end. That really settled it for me, Dr. Walton, whenever you said it, because I was really concerned about, where are we gonna put the sin at now? Who's gonna be, you know? I thought it was just Adam and his people and not the Gentiles.
Well, again, I've even tried to get more articulate about that with the archetypes idea. I don't know that Genesis is trying to talk about when sin began. It's trying to talk about how we all are subject to it. Mm-hmm. They are all of us. And, you know, Isaiah's statement, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. That's the Genesis story.
Right.
That's what it's about, how we all do this, always have, all the time. So I don't know that it's trying to give an ontology of sin. It's trying to show that that is the essence of human nature, that we want to do it our own way.
Yeah, that's incredible.
We've been created to be this community for God. We've been created to have this relationship as community with God, but yet we still choose the chaos for one reason or another. And it's a constant battle to be redirected into the order that we were naturally created to embody, which is in this communal space with our God and our Creator.
Right. We don't want to do it God's way. We want to do it our way.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. That's time old tradition.
Anyone who's ever had a toddler understands that. I do it myself.
Amen.
Yeah. That's all Cherry wants to do is what she wants to do.
But I will say this too, like having two toddlers, right? When my focus is keeping us in relationship with each other rather than keeping them in obedience with me, which is not the same thing all the time.
Right.
When I focus on keeping myself in relationship with them, the obedience falls into place naturally. Hmm. I had a moment where I blew up the other night and I was upset, and my 4-year-old was like, okay, mama, let's do a balloon breath. So her and I did a big balloon breath and then pop it.
Yeah.
And she said, okay, mama, count with me 4. So I counted 4 deep breaths and 4 deep breaths. And then my 4-year-old looked at me and said, what do you need?
Oh.
And I said, but here's the thing. I said, I'm feeling really overwhelmed because a lot of the times I'm being asked to do a lot of things and being asked to get water and being asked to make dinner and being asked to answer the phone and being asked. And I've been being pulled in so many directions. I'm feeling really overwhelmed. And she said, okay, well, I want you just to sit there and not do anything. I'm not going to ask anything. I'm just going to sit next to you and I'm going to read next to you. And I said, that would be really lovely. Thank you. But that moment didn't just happen.
I think your daughter is like toddlers. A psychoanalyst prodigy, actually, is what.
Right.
It's because that's how I talk to her.
Right. Right.
When she's screaming, when she won't put her clothes on, when she's not whatever, I don't focus on the obedience or disobedience. I focus on our relationship. And I focus on what we need to do as a family. I'm like, hey, what's going on with you? Are you hungry? This stuff usually isn't a challenge. Can I help you through something? You know? And then I respond by allowing her to do that for me when I'm needing that. Because that's the thing. Like, when we shift that paradigm of God as punisher, I made this comment the other day that, you know, I've said it on notes from the other side, that it's as if we all want a New Testament Jesus for ourselves, but we want an Old Testament God for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, if we could just focus on the idea that what God has been calling humanity to since the beginning is loving relationship, out of which naturally follows an obedience, because that means we all get to work together in harmony.
Yeah.
Instead of.
Go ahead, Dr. Walton.
That's a great insight. And that's exactly the way that we now go in Genesis 3. That is, as in Christian interpretation, we've always wanted to make that about disobedience. God gave a command and you disobeyed and you're dead and you're out and you're sinful.
Yeah.
And we're now treating it not as a command, but as a warning. With relationship in mind, not as disobedience, but rather ignoring the warning and therefore not being punished, but suffering the consequences. When you tell a child, don't touch the hot stove, that's not a command. I mean, you use imperatives and it's strong. You don't want them to do it, but that's not the point. It's not a command, thou shalt not touch hot stoves. It's in your relationship with them, you want what's good for them. And so you tell them not to do that. And if they do it, the stove's not punishing them and neither are you. They suffer the consequences. And I think that we need to start thinking about Genesis 3 in terms of relationship and violations of that relationship and the consequences that follow, instead of trying to make it, you know, this is the beginning of sin. And now, how did we all inherit it? Sorry, Mr. Augustine, I'm not sure you're asking the right question.
You know, you make a great point. And I think a lot of it has to do, again, with interpretation and translation and the way things, you know, whichever culture got a hold of it in the English language at the time, whether it's 1611 with King James or wherever, they have this interpretation. And so they write it out in that fashion. You know, like I put out today, Gen Xer, I'm a Gen Xer. I was raised on hose, water, and neglect, right? Yes. Like that's the funny part about being in Gen X. So, but in the little meme, the old man looked at him and says, oh, so you had running water? You know, like, so they had it worse. But I guess, you know, one of the things that you said, I can't remember where you say this at, Dr. Walton, but
they probably don't either.
But we've always interpreted, and listen, and Andy, here's something I wanted to point out to you. Religious sects break apart based on the division of words, just specific words.
Yeah.
Sometimes, even though—
Probably less than that.
Like, you remember me telling you, like, a punctuation put in an English Bible can actually split a sect. Like, they'll say, today you will be with me in paradise, or today, comma, you will be with me in paradise. Like, wherever they put it, you know, can completely split a sect. Well, Dr. Walton says something about, on the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. And we have groups that say, well, we know that he didn't die physically on that day, so therefore it's a spiritual death, and because of that, this is how we build our, you know, our theology. But that's really not what Dr. Walton says is being said in the language is, when you eat that, you are doomed. Do you still see it that way?
Yes. When you eat from it, you're doomed to death. Sentenced to death, you know, those kinds of things. That's your destiny. Death becomes your destiny when you eat from it. So it's not a matter of take a bite and you keel over within 24 hours. And, you know, some people get really hung up on this. They say, oh, so really what happened? Since Adam didn't die when he took a bite of the fruit, then that means that God lied and the serpent told the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see how extreme that becomes just because... you misinterpreted the phrase.
Well, if you commit murder, you're put up and they give you a sentence of death. You're not killed, not in our society. You're not killed right then. It might have been in ancient societies you were, but right, you know, you have time. You don't die immediately. Right. But, you know, death becomes our destiny until Christ steps into the void and changes our destiny if we so choose to let him.
Mm-hmm. So the same phrase is used with Jeremiah, where after he has proclaimed his prophecies of judgment, they say, this man deserves to die. It's the same phrase. And they throw him in a pit. You know, they don't kill him.
Yeah.
They throw him in a pit.
Right. Yeah. Well, does anybody have any final questions or final thoughts you want to ask Dr. Walton? He's been kind enough to give us an hour and 10 minutes of his time. So we're going to wrap this
up. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. I didn't know. I'm on my phone. It's all, you know me, Rick. I'll just leave it at that. But anyway, I just happened to come across I listened to the YouTube video that you linked us to. Phenomenal. I actually was in there talking to you with the earbud in my ear, watching it. My husband said, are you talking to someone? I'm just agreeing with you as I'm going. So it's very interesting. I really enjoyed it. And then today it was a mad dash to get home from work, but I come across another YouTube video of your interpretation of Job. And which book would I find the best one for that lecture that you were giving on that one?
I have a full commentary on Job, but I would recommend instead, there's a small paperback that I did with Tremper Longman called How to Read Job.
Okay.
And that would be your best entry into it.
All right. Well, I really enjoyed the lectures that I've been listening to and seeing. And so I didn't even realize until probably about 10 minutes before I started this here tonight, the number of books that you had written. And I mean, just hands down, I really have enjoyed what I have heard so far. So thank you for that.
Sure. You're quite welcome.
Yep. John Walton, the rock star, the Old Testament theologian rock star. So anybody got anything? One. Go ahead.
I only have one other question. In your new book that the one you did with your son, that is sort of this revision, do I need to familiarize myself with any more pastries? Are we going to add an eclair to the mix or anything, or is it still just the pie layer cake analogy?
I didn't revisit that analogy.
Okay.
You know, my daughter spent 10 years as a French pastry chef. So, so pastry analogies kind of come with the family setting, but.
Right. What you know.
Right. What you know. That's exactly right.
Yeah. I'm kind of joking, but just try to end it on a light note.
Rick Carter actually has a really interesting question because he and I talk about this a lot.
Oh yeah. We conversate a lot about a lot of things, and we've discussed the video that he shared with us to go over. We've discussed it quite a bit, and you're kind of a little bit going back to the analogy of the house and the home. First question would be that you would say the Bible is more of a home story than it would be a story about the house.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. So if it's a home story, then that means the house is already applied in the story.
It's assumed.
Right. Genesis 1:2, it starts right in and describes the earth and the sea. They're already there.
All right. So here's an interesting question, because we've gone and I've been a proponent of how much books do you read outside of the Bible, say in the pseudepigraphal world?
I read a lot of them. I just finished writing a 2-volume commentary on Daniel, 900 pages each volume. And you have to read a lot of the pseudepigraphal and apocryphal works to do that.
I totally understand that.
I don't understand what it means to write a 900-page anything.
No.
So I'm
wow.
I have so much reading to do. Is that available anywhere? Like, is there is that just an academic work that I have to subscribe to Koch Bridge?
I just turned in the page proofs of Volume 1 today, so that's not going to be out till the end of the year. So you've got time. You can read other things first. And Volume 2.
There's a whole backlog.
Volume 2 should be submitted to the publisher within the next couple of months.
Okay.
All right. Most people have an opinion, and we've gone through, and Rick and I have tried to do a study on a pseudepigraphal work called the Book of High Asher. Have you seen that any?
The Book of
Yasher? Yasher, High Asher, Jasher?
We say Jasher because it's with a J, but it's Yasher, right?
Yeah, Yasher.
It's mentioned in Joshua.
Well, that book is mentioned in Joshua, but the apocryphal one, the pseudepigraphal one, is not that book. It was just named after it. So
the original book is lost?
Correct.
Oh, correct. So it's not the original. We know that for sure.
Yeah.
Wow.
The original one's Hellenistic.
Ah.
Interesting.
Rick Carter, you and I.
That changes things, doesn't it?
I mean, it does.
Doesn't it, boys?
Hey, you suck on that.
That stinks for you.
No. Look, that's, you know, we read the Bible and it says, you know, is this not found in the book of Jasher? And then we see a book that's called Jasher. And so we start reading it. We don't know, you know, we don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, man, we don't even have very good English translations of the Bible. Honestly, we try our best, but we always have to go back and study really deep into the languages.
Translation is interpretation. So
I know.
Translations will always be wanting. You know, I did a book recently called Wisdom for Faithful Reading, Principles and Practices for Old Testament Interpretation.
I'm writing it down. Say it again.
Wisdom for Faithful Reading, Principles and Practices for Old Testament Interpretation. And in that, I've got a chapter on the idea that translation is interpretation and the implications of all of that.
Wow. Anybody else?
We're going to need a lot of links.
Yeah. Look, I'm just going to give you a link to his books. You guys just do a search on Dr. John H. Walton from Wheaton College.
Professor. I'm sitting here writing all these notes down.
Yeah, I mean, you can Google it. You know, you can deep seek it. No, I don't know. Deep seek it. Rick Carter told me never to deep seek. Anyway. Well,
you know, there's an Amazon page. You see them all.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. It's got them all.
Dr. Walton.
I tell you what, I'm a huge fan of just listening to it on 1.7 times because I really get it in there at that speed. I don't know what it is. I talk at that speed. I talk at 1.7.
You talk at 2.9. Let's just be real.
Yeah. And I think it's because I have ADHD. Like if I'm doing something, to sit and read letters and words, I have to like stop and do jumping jacks every like two pages or something. So like listening to it on speed while I'm doing something else, like I got that book in there, sir. And I was like, this is amazing. I can't wait to talk about this. So now I'm going to have to speak. I'm going to have to put all these books on Audible.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. John Walton, thank you so much for taking your time out. Oh, what's he got there?
The Cultural Background Study Bible? This is study Bible, and all the notes are cultural background. I was a general editor for the Old Testament, and Craig Keener is a general editor for the New Testament.
Mm. So I do the HarperCollins Study Bible is the one I always read.
All of the study notes are just cultural background, ancient literature, manners and customs, archaeology, history.
Wow. And you were, and maps. You worked in that, right? You were, your work is in that book.
I was a general editor. General editor in the Old Testament,
Wow.
So, Cultural Background Study Bible.
All right, NIV okay. Cultural Background Study Bible. Well, Dr. Walton, thank you so much for being on the Burroughs of Berea with us. I'm so thankful that you took the time out. I know you're a very busy man. You have a lot going on. You're going to be traveling all over the world, and you just squeezed out a little time for us, and it means a lot to me, so thank you.
Glad to be on. Always happy for the conversation. And I wish you all the best as you continue to learn and read.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Sarita, thanks for coming up from the house.
You know that's right.
Yep. And then Andy.
Hey. And I came from the house too.
Just right across the yard.
My house.
And then
not a state house.
Big Daddy.
Yo.
Thanks for making the trip.
I came
up
from the home.
You came from the home, not the house. Wow.
Call back.
I told you. Cherry, thanks for coming in from Biddeford, Maine.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Tiziana, you rock, even though you're lying to your children and hiding in the basement. I appreciate
it. I love them so much. Look,
if you can't pretend to not be home and have a glass of wine, then you can't be a mom.
Andy's telling on me because I am down here having a glass of wine. I've been trying to like carefully drink it off camera so I don't offend anyone. Oh, you said that.
Sorry, I didn't record the video.
Yeah,
I didn't
you
record
said the video. That, yeah.
All right. Anyway, guys. We will talk to you guys again next time on the Burroughs of Berea. Peace out.
Bye.
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 Hello, all you Burroughs listeners. If you guys want to help us financially keep this podcast going, just go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/theburrowsofberea. Let me say that again. www.patreon, that's patreon.com/theburrowsofberea. We have several different levels that you can give at. So again, if you'd like to help us keep this podcast on the air, then just give us all your money at www.patreon.com/theburrowsofberea. Thanks, guys.